Hello from the Audible Local Ledger, located in beautiful Mashpee, Massachusetts. The Audible Local Ledger is the part of the Massachusetts Radio Reading Network that covers the Cape, the Islands, and the South Coast. This is Eric. I'll be reading you selections from the e-edition of the Yarmouth Register, dated Friday, August 16th. If you miss any portion of our broadcast or would like to hear some of our special programming, please go to the audiblelocalledger.org website, where we have a week's worth of reading for your listening pleasure. Want to volunteer or donate to our nonprofit to keep us reading to the print impaired? It is tax deductible. Call 508-539-2030. And don't forget, the Ledger can now be heard on Alexa-enabled speakers like the Amazon Echo Dot. Just say these exact words: Alexa, play radio station Audible Local Ledger on TuneIn, and you'll have a clear connection to our readings. Now, on with the Yarmouth Register. Our first story has a headline that reads, "Author Urges Kids to Live the Best Version of Life," by Erica Matthews. When she was learning to walk, Erica Grace's mother noticed her moving on her tiptoes rather than with a normal gait. Upon testing, they learned she had juvenile arthritis, a chronic and painful condition that required several hospitalizations while Grace was a child. Today, Grace has arthritis throughout all the joints in her body. Her easy smile and warm nature belie the hospitalizations and pain she's felt throughout the years. Last spring, she self-published a book, Great Like You, to give advice to teens and children also facing chronic illness. Beyond medical treatment, Grace grew up feeling different, not being able to play sports or attend gym class due to her condition. The illness made her mature very fast, quote-unquote, and taught her how to communicate with doctors instead of relying solely on her parents for information. Quote, "I had issues with trusting doctors, but I found ways to interact with them so I felt more comfortable," she said. "Sometimes for the children it can be scary to go to hospital visits and have blood drawn, things like that. For me, it was realizing the doctors were part of my team. You have to be open, you have to communicate with them. I tell the reader, you're an expert of your body." The book is broken down into bite-sized advice for keeping positive and setting goals. Readers are given space at the end of each chapter to write their own reflections. Born and raised on Cape Cod and a 2002 graduate of Dennis Yarmouth Regional High School, she now lives in Arizona with her husband. Quote, "Nowadays, teens are facing so many more challenges, and I wanted to provide them support and a resource guide they could use and refer back to," she said. Not many books in the self-help genre are geared towards young people. Grace was raised in Yarmouth, where her parents, Chris and Suzanne Kenny, still live. Despite a busy schedule and full-time corporate job in finance, Grace felt called to write a book that would help others facing similar health challenges. Through her job, she was going to women's entrepreneurial events and got her reflecting on what she could do to help others. The book was released on Amazon in December of 2018, hitting number one in the teen health category. Grace wanted the title to include the word superhero, but realized Marvel Comics has a copyright on it. She went through about 300 titles before deciding on Great Like You. The book also addresses later diagnoses in children who have lost functionality they once had. Quote, "It can be especially hard when you're 10 and you can no longer play sports," she said. "I learned perseverance and spirit are things you have to keep up. Work on visualization and goal setting. Think about the next big dream." Despite all the positivity, Grace notes in her book that she had and still has hard days, and that the readers may too. "I always worked on my mindset, and that's what I try to impress upon the readers," she said. "I teach techniques and tools to deal with those curveballs. You shine a light that attracts others to you," Grace writes in her book. "Your happiness signals to others that you're living your own best version of your life." The next story has a headline, "Two Charged in Cocaine Arrest in West Yarmouth." Two people with previous drug charges against them were arrested at the Yarmouth-Hyannis line on Thursday, August 15th, after an alleged drug sale. According to a statement from the Yarmouth Police Department, at 7:30 p.m., Yarmouth Police Officer Matt Mangano and Detective Scott Lundergan observed a hand-to-hand drug transaction at Baker Square at the Yarmouth-Hyannis town line in West Yarmouth. Quote, occupants in a vehicle involved in the drug distribution parked at the Race Mart gas station. They were encountered and identified. All had criminal records involving illegal drugs. Police said the alleged drug sale took place in a car parked at the Race Mart gas station. Arrested were Christy Ann Hennigan, 33, of Marston's Mills, charged with possession of cocaine, subsequent offense. Stephanie L. Pierre, 46, of Dennis, charged with possession to distribute cocaine. Both were due to be arraigned in Barnstable District Court. Cash recovered from the scene was seized as, quote, suspected proceeds of narcotic distribution. Several cell phones were also seized by police. The next headline, YMCA studies expansion to Dennis or Harwich by Susan Vaughn. The idea of opening a new YMCA in Dennis or Harwich is still very much alive and may be gaining support. Brad Kroll, representing a group called the YMCA Lower Cape Initiative, met with Dennis Selectman on Tuesday night to review the status of the proposal. He said sites near exits 9, 10, and 11 are being considered for a new facility to serve the area. The YMCA also has a facility on Route 132 in West Barnstable. The idea was floated in Dennis a few years ago for a combined senior community center, but there was a lack of interest in a community center, and plans were adopted for an expanded senior center. But sentiment seems to have changed. An online survey by the Y drew an unexpected 813 participants in 3 weeks that indicated lots of community sports and support and enthusiasm for the idea of another YMCA, Kroll said. While the seniors' needs are generally well served, the survey discovered needs, especially for youth, traditional sports programs, as well as non-sport programs in all ages, were yearning for a connection, Kroll said. The community is pushing us to do this. Some Y services have already been moving into the Lower Cape, including early childhood education programs at Cape Cod Regional Technical High School, Nauset, Monomoy, and Dennis Yarmouth High Schools. Harwich and Chatham just approved new YMCA preschool programs at the elementary schools. A new Y building would include a pool and a gym, Kroll said. The YMCA Lower Cape Initiative Committee wants to do two more studies related to the new building project, market feasibility, and a capital campaign feasibility for which $50,000 is needed. The committee may be calling on individual donors to fund those studies. Quote, we've had multiple offers of land, Kroll said. I'm cautiously optimistic we won't have to spend capital on land. Selectman John Terrio said he knows there's a need for the new facility. The selectman took no action on the proposal. The Lower Cape Initiative is not the only possible expansion for YMCA programs on Cape Cod. A group called Falmouth Wants a Y is working to open a YMCA on the Upper Cape. The headline reads, Baxter Mill Project aims to restore a piece of Yarmouth's past. The project to restore Mill Pond and the historic Baxter Mill on Route 28 in West Yarmouth is well underway and will take months to complete. First things first, however, people ask if all the work will harm the nesting swans who call the pond home. Quote, the construction will not affect the swans, said Director of the Yarmouth Department of Natural Resources, Carl Van Hoen. They're building a dam and a bypass pipe. There should be plenty of water for the swans. Von Hoen said the nesting pair that occupies the pond had two young this spring, but the two were killed, likely by natural predators. He said the nesting pair may choose to relocate on their own, but will not be forced to do so by the construction work. As for the project, the goal is to reinforce the existing dam, improve the ladder for herring, and make the Baxter Mill a viable mill and tourist attraction once again. The $1.5 million project is being paid for with $1.1 million in Community Preservation Act money and about $400,000 from a Natural Resources Conservation Service grant. The NRCS, part of the United States Department of Agriculture, helps America's farmers, ranchers, and forest landowners conserve the nation's soil, water, air, and other natural resources. All programs are voluntary and offer science-based solutions that benefit both the landowner and the environment, according to its website. Von Hohn said the new fish ladder that will be built as part of the project should allow for much easier and better movement of herring, alewives, and American eels into and out of the pond. Jeff Colby, Yarmouth's director of the Department of Public Works, said improvements being made to the spillway will allow water to move more efficiently through the grist mill. He said that when the project's finished, it'll be possible to once again make the mill operable like similar mills in Brewster and Sandwich. As for the dam reconstruction portion of the project, Colby said riprap will be placed on the pond, below the water level, and sheeting will be added to create a more impermeable barrier than the existing earthen dam. Quote, the chain-link fence will be removed and the turf will allow some erosion protection on the downstream side of the dam. He said that even if there is overtopping of the dam, the impact will be lessened. The Baxter Grist Mill dates to 1710 on the site. The mill stayed in the Baxter family until 1860, then passed to a series of owners and eventually became town property. The dam at Mill Pond failed twice more than 100 years ago. In 1960 and 1961, the mill, which is about 20 feet square, was given a major restoration by George Kelly and A. Harold Castengay. In 1989, it underwent another renovation under the guidance of Morris Johnson of the Yarmouth Department of Natural Resources. It has not been a functioning mill, however, since the 1980s. For years, it was a tourist attraction, although it wasn't a working mill, and it's been closed to the public for about a dozen years. In 2017, Yarmouth Town Meeting voters approved the funding for the latest restoration, which should take until the fall to complete. The next headline reads, A New Address, Apartments Revitalize South Yarmouth Neighborhood. This is written by John Basile, who's also the editor, if I am not mistaken, of the Yarmouth Register. What was for years the site of a derelict property in South Yarmouth will soon become a vital part of the community when residents begin moving into the Yarmouth Commons apartments. The 69-unit development was built on the site of the former Cavalier Motor Lodge, once a thriving motel, but in its later years a troubled property. Dakota Partners paid $22.5 million but got more than $2 million in Community Preservation Act funds from Yarmouth and $4.55 million from the state. Quote, I think the town was extraordinary with us. They really worked with us very cooperatively, said developer Roberto Arista. The original proposal, which was filed in 2016, called for a much larger development that included retail space. After hearing complaints from neighbors, Dakota Partners made some changes. Quote, I think the neighbors were pleased in the end. We did make some deals with the neighbors regarding density and traffic patterns, which is all fine, Arista said. Construction began last year. Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito, who toured the property on July 30th, stressed that by combining public and private resources, the project was successful. This property wasn't producing tax revenue to the municipality, Polito said, noting, now it will. She also emphasized that it helps fill a need for workforce housing. Quote, in fact, they'll have a bus stop right out front so that people can take a bus and get to their destination. We want to see more of this, not only on the Cape, but everywhere. As Polito and other state and local officials toured Yarmouth Commons on July 30th, finishing touches were being applied to the buildings. A painter was at work in a corridor as the tour group got a look at some of the apartments. There were about 650 applicants for the 69 apartment units. About 250 applicants came from people who already live in Yarmouth. Arista said the development still makes financial sense despite being smaller than originally envisioned. Robert Lawton of the Yarmouth Affordable Housing Trust said the trust is, quote-unquote, very happy with the project. Quote, the developer was ready to work with us, which is a big plus, Lawton said. He was willing to take suggestions. The Affordable Housing Trust will next turn its attention to the redevelopment of the Yarmouth Gardens Motel property on Route 28 in West Yarmouth, where a similar but smaller development is being proposed. At Yarmouth Commons, 7 units will be rented to low-income residents under a government-subsidized program. The remainder of the apartments will be rented to people meeting income guidelines that range from $36,240 a year for a one-person household to $60,000 a year for a six-person household. Two of the buildings in the development are two stories. One has 19 units and the other has 20. One of the buildings is three stories and contains 30 units. Dakota Partners, based in Waltham, quote, acquires and develops multifamily rental communities and for-sale projects across New England and the Mid-Atlantic, according to its website. Quote, at the core of every project is Dakota's mission to improve the lives of the people who live in our communities by integrating high-level design, green building technologies, and traditional craftsmanship. Dakota creates vibrant and desirable projects. Additionally, partnerships with neighborhood groups and public officials ensure the success of these projects for all stakeholders in the community, the website says. More information on Yarmouth Commons and Dakota Partners can be found at www.dakotapartners.net, or you can call 781-899-4002. The next headline in the Yarmouth Register reads, More Licenses Suspended as RMV Backtracking Continues, by Chris Lisinski of the Statehouse News Service. The Registry of Motor Vehicles suspended the licenses of more than 800 additional drivers in its ongoing review of potential missed violations, with thousands more requiring additional examination, officials said in a status update Thursday. More than 2,400 Massachusetts residents have now had their permission to drive revoked in the past 6 weeks based on out-of-state violations that the RMV spurred into action in the wake of a fatal crash previously failed to handle. The latest batch, as detailed in the fifth interim report RMV officials have issued since the scandal became clear, came from what officials called an unprecedented effort to compare records of all 5.2 million drivers across the state with a national database that tracks violations and infractions. Through that review, the RMV identified serious violations warranting suspensions for 869 drivers, interim registrar Jamie Tesler, wrote Thursday. Close to 2,900 others were flagged by the process but didn't fully match personal identification factors, so workers continue to review those cases to determine if further suspensions are warranted. Tesler said in his update that the RMV also expects an interim report by the end of the week from national audit firm Grant Thornton, which was tapped to conduct an independent review of how the RMV for years failed to act on warnings from other states about Massachusetts drivers who should have their licenses suspended. RMV officials have also begun the process of notifying other states about their drivers who have been convicted or suspended in Massachusetts. That's another process the registry didn't do regularly for years before the current upheaval. About 45,000 notices dating back to March of 2018, when the RMV switched over to a new Atlas computer system, have been produced and will be sent, Tesler said. The systemic management breakdowns became clear to the public after a Massachusetts man who was arrested on OUI charges in Connecticut, something that should have triggered a suspension of his commercial license, allegedly killed 7 motorcyclists in a June crash in New Hampshire. However, testimony from several RMV employees, including former registrar Aaron Deveni, who resigned amid the scandal, indicated that there were multiple warnings about the registry's growing backlog of out-of-state notices, but little action to remedy the situation. In 2016, the RMV's driver control unit head, Keith Constantino, successfully proposed shifting responsibility for processing the notifications to the Merit Rating Board, a data entry division. But the board never made significant progress, and after a software change in March 2018, it altogether abandoned out-of-state notices to prioritize handling Massachusetts citations. Merit Rating Board Director Thomas Bowes told lawmakers last month that he didn't have the manpower for out-of-state. Tesler wrote in Thursday's report that while the Merit Rating Board had roughly level staff levels over the past 5 years, it struggled to manage its daily tasks and work queues because of challenges sharing data in an efficient manner with local police, courts, and other departments. As of Thursday, the rating board had about 22,000 work items, a broad term that doesn't refer directly to individual driver cases still needing resolution. Moving forward, he said, the RMV and judicial leaders will meet to develop a more collaborative system so that employees can handle the workload. Tesler also called for the Merit Rating Board's Oversight Board, which consists of the registrar, commissioner of insurance, and either the attorney general or a representative from the office, to revive its role after an unspecified period of inactivity. Quote, it does not appear that the MRB Oversight Board has met in a public fashion, with the meeting posted and minutes kept for some time, Tesler wrote. Recent events have highlighted the importance of MRB and of the board's statutorily defined role as an oversight board for the agency's responsibility to maintain driver records. Tesler said he reached out to Attorney General Maura Healey and Commissioner of Insurance Gary Anderson to schedule a meeting. Healey's office told the news service that they've requested several times for the board to convene. She's investigating Westfield Transport, the company that hired the driver, allegedly involved in the New Hampshire crash, but declined to comment on any additional action. Other internal reforms are underway in the wake of the scandal. The RMV will hire a deputy registrar for safety, a chief compliance officer, and a director of policy, and it's working to launch an all-new team to handle out-of-state notifications. Two supervisors on that team will be hired by August 19th, Tesler wrote, and four additional employees, either full-time or temporary workers, will be on board by early September. Representative William Strauss, co-chair of the Joint Committee on Transportation investigating the RMV, said in a Wednesday afternoon statement that the latest status report is, quote, another acknowledgement that major management and operational flaws at the agency allowed serious traffic violators to hold on to their Massachusetts licenses when they should have been suspended. While it's helpful to see that changes are planned, today's report sheds little light on how this failure within the agency occurred or what was allowed to happen, Strauss wrote. Strauss and co-chair, Senator Joseph Boncour, have been pushing the Baker administration to release a full swath of documents they requested to aid in their investigation. Last week, they sent a searing letter to Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollock, hinting that if their final request for full participation was not met, they may seek subpoena power. Pollock said earlier in the week that several batches of documents have since been handed over, and Tesler's report said the committee has been provided close to 50,000 pages of materials. However, Strauss expressed frustration that RMV documents related to the central questions of when and how the records-keeping breakdown occurred still have not yet been provided. The administration's efforts to fully share documents in its possession are now clouded by indications that the administration has identified materials which it might withhold from disclosure to the committee, Strauss wrote. Quote, the chairs have already made clear that the cooperation is expected and required from the administration. I would encourage the secretary to enhance her cooperation without delay. Up next, we have an opinion piece by Jim Coogan, an old shark story. The recent increase in shark sightings around Cape Cod has brought a number of concerns. For beachgoers, there's the decision of either going into the water or staying safely on the shore. Certainly a risk, as shown by the shark attack that killed a young surfer off Wellfleet last summer. The truth is that there have always been sharks in Cape waters, but sightings were unusual and attacks rare. In June of 1929, the Barnstable Patriot newspaper reported that a naval officer vacationing at Craigville Beach was bitten on the hand by a small shark while swimming. The injury was minimal, didn't create much of a stir. Today, sharks are here because of the great number of seals that inhabit our waters. As the seal population has increased, so also have we seen more sharks. It's a new summer reality. In many ways, the dilemma faced by Cape towns about whether sharks will discourage tourists from coming here is much like the situation portrayed in the movie Jaws. Even when it was pretty clear that a dangerous man-eating shark was cruising the waters off Amity Island, the selectmen in that fictitious place were loath to acknowledge that it was out there. What would be the effect on the summer business season if the public knew a dangerous shark was lurking just beyond the bathing beaches? They tried to keep it under wraps for as long as they could. It's different for us. We've acknowledged that we've got a shark problem, and now it's more of a case of how to manage it while keeping beachgoers safe. As to solutions, we've seen suggestions of going after the sharks and killing them, or perhaps the placement of sonar alert systems. Surfers could maybe wear electromagnetic repellents. Some have suggested putting a bounty on seals to control the burgeoning population. We're still in the, quote, not real sure, but we've got to try something stage. Back in the early 1970s, there was a shark scare in Dennis that had people wondering if they should stay out of the water. A very large great white shark with a lot of teeth drifted dead onto the shore at Corporation Beach. Officials closed the beach for a time, wondering if there might be more of them out in the bay. The truth of how that shark got to Dennis didn't come out until quite a bit later, when a couple of fishermen fessed up over a few drinks in a Manomet saloon. It seems the two had left Plymouth Harbor one morning for a day of deep-sea fishing, a few miles offshore just east of Race Point. Back then, the Russian fishing fleet would anchor just outside the then 12-mile limit. There were enough of them that at night, with all the ship lights burning, it looked like a small city out there. Anyway, these two guys decided they would motor out to see the Russians. They came up on a big cannery ship and saw a really large shark hanging from a gaff off the stern of the vessel. The fishermen communicated with the Russians that they wanted the shark. Trading a couple of watches and some cigarettes with the sailors, they brought the big creature aboard their own boat. Waving goodbye, they started back across the bay toward Plymouth, where they had plans of boasting to everyone about the big catch they had made. As it was, the wind came up and there was enough chop that the two worried that the heavily laden boat might founder. Reluctantly, they tossed the dead shark overboard. The carcass eventually drifted onto the beach in Dennis, causing an understandable stir. People avoided the place. Over the next couple of days, there was another reason why people stayed away from Corporation Beach. The dead shark began to stink, something awful. Finally, under the direction of Harbor Master Skip Howes, Bob Crowell had some of his DPW boys haul the fish to the dump. I suspect the remains of that old sea creature are still there. And Jim Coogan is a Register columnist. And we'll leave you with just a little bit of sports. Yarmouth Dennis fine season ends in division finals. By George Costinas. Sometimes the 44-game schedule in the Cape Cod Baseball League can become a long season. That proved to be true for the Yarmouth-Dennis Red Sox this summer. While the Red Sox played hard right down to the end, they just didn't have enough to get past the Harwich Mariners in the second round of the East Division playoffs. The Mariners beat the Red Sox in two games to advance to the league's championship finals and lost in two games to the Kituat Cutlers. YD lost the first game to Harwich 5-1 despite out-hitting the Mariners 11-5. The Red Sox just didn't do what they'd been so good at all season, getting the two-out RBI. Quote, we had guys on third base in three innings. We couldn't get that two-out or one-out knock to get the momentum going, said YD field manager Scott Pickler. We just didn't produce with guys in scoring position. We left 15 guys on base. In addition, the Red Sox uncharacteristically committed five errors that led to three unearned runs. In the second game, the Red Sox got a real good pitching performance from Ryan Hare from UNLV. In six innings, he gave up only two hits and walked only one batter while striking out seven. When he left the game, the score was tied at 1-1. We had to take our starter out. He had thrown 60 pitches, so we went to the pen and they attacked our pen. Give them credit. They produced, said Pickler. The Mariners got a walk and a double and scored on a sacrifice fly. With two outs, they got another single to drive in a run, and there was a two-run homer. When the inning finally ended, Harwich had scored four runs and had a 5-1 lead. Wyatt Young from Pepperdine led the team in batting this year with a .338 average and was in competition for the league batting title for most of the season. Noah Campbell from the South Carolina Columbia School had a very good season, batting .324, as did King, who hit .323, and Austin Wells from Arizona, who finished the season with a .308 batting average. Bradley Beasley from Cal San Luis Obispo struggled in the first part of the season, really improved, and finished with a .280 batting average. It made it particularly hard to say goodbye after a final loss to Harwich. That's the toughest part, when you have to say goodbye, especially when they're good people, Pickler said. You've been listening to the Yarmouth Register, read for you by Eric. If you missed any portion of this program, you can go to the audiblelocalledger.org website, where we keep a week's worth of our readings archived for your listening pleasure. If you're interested in donating or volunteering to read to the print impaired, you can call 508-539-2030. This is Eric, wishing you a great weekend. Bye for now.